This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Have you worried that a big burp of methane will boil out of the Arctic Sea and roast us all with sudden heat? You know, the Arctic methane bomb hypothesis. Brand new science, published in two top journals, concludes that is not going to happen anytime soon. Even though a couple of Russian scientists have pushed this fear, is it a distraction from that country's massive methane emissions due to their natural gas production and pipelines? The real methane we have to fear is coming from the oil and gas industry, says Michael Dionysius, lead author or co-author in two of those new studies. For anyone concerned about climate change, this interview is stunning, good and bad news. Are you worried about the methane monster bursting out of the permafrost or the Arctic seabed? New science says the real threat is much closer to home. Two new papers pinpoint the real culprit of growing methane, the oil and gas industry. This is very big news science. The bad news is methane from fossil fuels is warping world weather. The good news, it is us and not nature who causes and controls the worst emissions of this greenhouse gas. It all comes in two new papers based on projects measuring air from ice cores in Antarctica and Greenland. Our guest is Michael Dionysius, who led one paper and co-authored the other. Michael is a PhD candidate at the University of Rochester, a private research university in New York State. Michael Dionysius, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is going to be cool. Now, when was the most recent time that Earth was warmer than today?
It depends on the region, but I think one of the most recent time is the period we call the Holocene Climate Optimum. It occurred around 10,000 to 8,000 years ago. So this is when the Earth was coming out of the last glacial maximum. In the last glacial maximum, you know, we have like ice sheets covering essentially all of Canada, and then a large chunk of the United States, New York City, was under a mile of ice sheets. And then the ice sheet kind of melts away naturally through changes in solar insulation. And then there's a little bit of an overshoot effect. That's the period that is the Holocene climate optimum, around 10,000 to 8,000 years ago. In this period, overall, the planet is about 0.2 to 0.4 degrees warmer, but the Arctic specifically is about 1 to 2 degrees warmer than today. So this is kind of like what we're looking forward to in the next couple of decades, what would it look like.
So why did you go to Antarctica to check the atmosphere over 10,000 years ago?
The way ice cores work is that as snow accumulates on top of ice sheets, you know, snow is porous, so it traps air in the interstitial space between the snow grains. And then as the snow compacts further into ice, the air in between the grains are trapped forever as air bubbles. And so through ice cores, actually, we could measure what was in the atmosphere thousands of years ago. So this exact is literally the sample of a piece of atmospheric air back through time. So we went to Greenland and Antarctica just to get a sample of air from the past.
So when the planet was up to half a degree C warmer than it is today, what did your ice core samples tell you about methane emissions in that warmer time? Were they extreme? Were they really bad?
The methane is still lower than today, actually. It's about half than today. So human emissions have almost more than doubled the methane concentration from the pre-industrial period to what we call the modern period or today. So even during this period where everything was warmer, methane was actually lower than today.
But how do you know that methane from ice in Antarctica represents the general atmosphere of that time instead of just local conditions at the pole?
We know based on several things. So first of all, there is continuity. So we have methane measurements today dating back all the way from the 80s in South Pole. So it's measured in situ in South Pole from the NOAA monitoring network. And then beyond the South Pole, we have what we call fern air. So this is air that is in the interstitial space in the snow grains that we could pump out of the ice sheets that is slightly older than 1980s. and it matches right into what are the in situ measurements in South Pole. The reason why we know it's representative of global methane concentration, or should we say almost global, because methane is slightly higher in the northern hemisphere than in the southern hemisphere. So Greenland and Antarctic ice cores actually measure methane with slight offsets between them. But we know they represent global methane, not local methane, because we know the atmospheric lifetime of methane. So methane is removed in the atmosphere from oxidation with what we call OH radical. And average lifetime of one molecule of methane is about 9 years, while the interhemispheric mixing between atmosphere is about 1 year. So methane is what we call globally well mixed, although obviously methane is higher in regions where it's emitted by a lot, but still it's globally well mixed and there is a global baseline of methane.
Now, we know large amounts of methane have been resting on the seafloor for a very long time, captured in ice structures that we call clathrates. And a few scientists, including the Russians, Natalia Shakova and Igor Samilyatov, have warned those clathrates are starting to thaw under the shallow East Siberian seabed. And as you know, a whole culture of worry and, well, doom have grown up around that. Michael, what makes you think that concern has been misplaced?
Just want to talk a little bit about the tracer that we use both in mine and bend studies. So we use a tracer, what we call a radiocarbon of methane. So it's a C14 measurement in the methane phase. So C14 is produced in the atmosphere basically from cosmic rays bombardment and reacting with nitrogen in the atmosphere to produce C14. And then the C14 is integrated into the biosphere because, you know, plants take up CO2 and then use it to build carbon as part of their, like, body parts through photosynthesis. And then when this plant dies, they either rot in a wetland and then get re-emitted as methane back to the atmosphere, or if the plants got eaten by a cow and then the cow's stomach have bacteria that produce methane and get emitted through the cow burps. So that's what we call contemporaneous methane. And the methane in these contemporaneous sources like the wetlands or cows or plants, they have the C14 content that is similar to atmospheric CO2. However, there's also fossil methane, and this is methane that have been isolated from the atmosphere for a while. So the clathrate that our colleagues are measuring in the ocean floor, or the methane in permafrost, or the methane in natural gas, they don't have C14 in it. So what we did is we go back to our ice cores and we measure C14 of methane in periods where methane jumps naturally. So there were two big jumps of methane when the Earth was coming out of the last glacial maximum. Methane almost doubled in what we call the oldest, driest Bolling-Alerod transition. And then methane also doubles in what we call the younger, driest transition. And people have been debating, like, what was causing this methane concentration rise during these two abrupt transitions. This transition happened in less than 100 years. And during these transitions, Greenland actually warmed by like 5-6 degrees. So that is pretty extreme natural variability in Earth's climate. And when we measure the C14 of methane, we only see the contemporaneous C14 methane. So the C14 content of methane that we measure in our ice cores was similar to C14 of CO2. And we know the C14 of CO2 really well from tree rings. And they all just measure about the same after we do the age correction. And that suggests that all this methane during the doubling of methane, during the oldest, driest Bolling warming, and then during the younger, driest warming, is all from contemporaneous source. Because if there's any fossil source like the clathrate destabilizing and releasing methane to the atmosphere, then we would see a depletion in the C14 of methane from the ice cores.
So we could go, say, half a degree C warmer than we are right now and not expect to see a big burp of methane coming up from the clathrates or the permafrost according to what happened the last time. But we have to remember that some scientists are now warning that we could warm another 1.5 degrees C by the end of this century. So does that overcome the assurances that you made in your new research? I mean, you told one journalist that's one climate catastrophe we can check off.
Yes, our research specifically pertains to the old methane. And we identify several buffer mechanisms that prevent this methane from reaching the atmosphere. So methane hydrates and permafrost are two different things. So methane hydrates, or as we mentioned it before, clathrates, they're just synonym. These are C14 dead methane, so they don't have any C14 in it. They're about thousands or hundreds of thousands of years in the ocean floor. And they're always in the ocean floor because they're not stable if under low pressure. And there's modern experiment done by our friends at British Petroleum when they did the deep water horizon spill. They drill into a clathrate deposit and it explodes and it releases tons of methane to the water column. But actually, we don't see any of those methane made it to the atmosphere. And scientists, including John Kessler, who also works in my department, and Carolyn Ruppel, who is the head of the United States Geological Survey Hydrate Program, measure that all of those methane released from the clathrate are actually oxidized by bacteria in the water column. With regards to clathrate catastrophe, I think the BP oil spill and also my research happened to suggest that the oxidative capacity of the water column is so strong that the methane released from clathrates would likely not made it to the atmosphere. With regards to permafrost, it's slightly different because permafrost doesn't only emit C14 dead methane. There could be something in between. So what we mean by C14 dead is that if it's more than 2 or 3 half-lives of C14, which is around 6,000 years, then all of the C14 are depleted. But permafrosts are actually a lot of permafrosts today are about 5,000 to 10,000 years, so they're not quite C14 free. And what we only measure is the C14 free component of the permafrost emissions. We say that the old organic soil in permafrost were not emitted to the atmosphere as methane, but as permafrost melt, it could also, like, if you have plants that grow like last year, and then the plants die, and the permafrost melt, it creates what we call a thermocrust lake, which is basically a permafrost melt lake, and then the plant rot on the bottom of the lake, and then it releases methane. The methane released from those plants would still have C14 in it, and that's not part of our study. So with permafrost, we have to be slightly more careful than with clathrate. With clathrate, I think we could safely say that it's checked off, that this oxidative capacity or the water column is so strong. But with permafrost, we only say that the old organic carbon in permafrost are not reactivated and joining the ocean atmosphere carbon cycle.
So we're talking about a paper titled Old Carbon Reservoirs Were Not Important in the Deglacial Methane Budget. Our guest, Michael Dionysius, is the lead author. It was published in the journal Science on February 21st, 2020.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. So let's move on to another issue here. In March 2019, Professor Ewan Nisbet from the Royal Holloway, University of London, told us about his tests of flasks of air gathered from all over the world. He concluded that recent increases in methane were principally coming from tropical bogs, especially in East Africa. But you and Benjamin Hamil and Vivi Petrenko just published a second paper, this time in the journal Nature, February 19th. And it sounds like this new research points at the oil and gas industry instead?
A couple of things to clarify. So first of all, with this study, we measure fern air and ice core from Greenland. So we're moving away from Antarctica. And the reason why we moved to Greenland is because the accumulation rate is higher in Greenland. So it's easier to access air that is about pre-industrial age. So pre-industrial is around 1800s before James Watt invented the steam engine and start burning coal and emitting a bunch of fossil fuel to the atmosphere. And so we also measure radiocarbon of methane in those fern air and ice cores from Greenland. And basically what we see is that before 1850, basically there is no fossil methane in the atmosphere. And then the fossil methane starts to ramp up around 1850, coincidental with the pre-industrial period. And then, unfortunately, there's a gap because the bomb spike happened. So this is in the 1950s. There's a lot of nuclear testing, a lot of nuclear bomb being detonated, and it spiked the atmospheric C14. So you remember our discussion with the tracers of how C14 of methane worked. Now the contemporaneous source like wetlands and biomass burning, plants, cows, they all emit enriched C14 methane. So that the proxies sadly doesn't work these days or today or beyond 1950, but it works in the past. So as I mentioned, another source of methane that people think is real is what we call natural geologic emissions. So it's basically seeps of natural gas that happens naturally. So through like a fault in a rock formation or through mud volcanoes or just seepage like that. And actually, when we go back to the pre-industrial, we see that there is almost no fossil methane. So that means that these seepage that we think was natural was actually just fossil fuel emissions. So that's why we say that anthropogenic fossil fuel emission was underestimated today. But we actually did not directly address the present methane rise from 2008 to today. What we mean by present in the paper was actually the methane stabilization period. So we're not saying that fossil fuel was responsible for the methane rise that we're currently seeing. What we're saying is that fossil fuel has been higher all along under our nose.
You know, one thing I love about both these studies is they're based on ice core records. They're real solid measurements in the real world. They're not models. They're not projections. So it's kind of hard to argue with your work, but some scientists have attempted to argue with your work, and there's been some pushback to your conclusions. What have you heard?
Some of the pushbacks are not related to the measurements, because I think, and we spend like 90% of the time making sure the measurement is good. So with regards to the one pushback with regards to Ben's studies from Daniel Jacob at Harvard is that he's saying that, all right, we clearly show that natural geologic emission was small, but it doesn't mean that anthropogenic fossil fuel has to be higher. It could also mean that we just overestimate natural geologic emission. And in that way, if fossil fuel stays where it is and natural geologic emission was small, then he could balance the methane budget. So we have a problem these days with the methane budget between the discrepancy between what we call top-down inversions and bottom-up measurements. In top-down measurements, we have monitoring stations across the world. Some stations are slightly better than others, but the point is that we could figure out how much methane in total is coming out just from these measurements, from atmospheric measurement. The bottom-up measurement is that you go to a lake or you go to a permafrost and you have a bucket atmosphere. And unfortunately, scientists are attracted to big hot spots, or like just we want to measure where methane, there's a lot of methane or there's a lot of interesting things. So the bottom-up studies actually overestimate the amount of methane compared to what the top-down inversion shows. So there's this basically gap in the budget that have to be reconciled. So one argument from Daniel Jacob is that, all right, so if we say that fossil natural geologic emission is low, then you just close the gap and we solve the problem. You don't have to increase the fossil fuel component. An argument against that is that in the paper we do box model of stable isotopes of methane. This time we're talking about C13 to C12 ratio of methane rather than the radiocarbon that we've been talking previously. And when we do the stabilized isotopes box model, it seems like the fossil fuel component still needs to be higher. So that's kind of like our answer to the argument that you should just have the natural geologic emissions lower and don't increase the fossil fuel component.
Well, everything you're saying matches up with what we've heard here on this show. I mean, I interviewed in January 2020 the energy reporter Nick Cunningham, and he told us about companies fracking for oil in West Texas legally venting tons of natural gas into the air. They just blow it up there. And we've seen air samples showing fracking is emitting significant amounts of methane, and natural gas pipelines from Russia to America are pretty leaky. So are the distribution systems in the city. So it just makes common sense. We had that 2018 study by Ramon Alvarez that found methane coming from the oil and gas supply chain much higher than what the government said. So it all seems to back up the conclusion that you come through. Now, is the increase in methane large enough to derail this goal of keeping global warming well below 2 degrees as set in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Ewan Nisbet actually wrote a paper about that we're way off target from Paris Agreement just because of the methane emissions that has been unexpectedly increasing, because methane was stabilizing around 2000 to 2009, and then it just keeps ramping up. And the rate of methane increase today is about as high or higher than what we've ever seen in all ice core history. And so, yeah, we're way off target for Paris for the methane rise. But we're still not sure whether it's 100% fossil fuel or it could be other thing, because obviously, so with regards to the stable isotopes methane, there are three main hypotheses. The first one is the one that Ewan Nisbet proposed. That is the most straightforward hypothesis. What happened currently is that atmospheric methane concentration is rising, and the atmospheric methane stable isotope is becoming depleted, so it becomes way lighter. So Ewan Nisbet proposed that it's actually the wetlands, the bogs in the tropics that are driving this isotopic depletion and methane increase. That's because the wetlands are emitting very negative, very light methane. So that is the most straightforward hypothesis. The second hypothesis is that you could also increase fossil fuel, but you need to make room in the budget for also a decrease in biomass burning. If you don't decrease the biomass burning, then the isotope budget doesn't quite work out with increase in fossil fuel, because fossil fuel have slightly higher stable isotopes than microbial emission from wetlands. And argument about reduction in biomass burning, obviously we know the terrible fires in Australia and Amazon last year. Just from that perspective, it's fairly strenuous, but there's also massive reduction in or fire suppression happening in the Northern Hemisphere, because when there's fire now, people have concerted effort to put it down. So that could be also correct. And the third hypothesis is that there's actually just simply, so the sinks of methane, what removes methane from the atmosphere is reaction with OH radical. And the OH radical only exists in atmosphere for about 1 second. So it's a very reactive molecule. And we cannot actually measure them, because if you trap them in a flask and you bring them to the lab, they're gone. And they're constantly produced by sunlight, so they're constantly appearing and disappearing, and it's very hard to measure it. So we have to rely on models. Some models suggest that the OH radical have been decreasing, so basically means that we're just removing less methane from the atmosphere. So those are the three hypotheses. And at the moment, unfortunately, we don't have enough measurements or constraints to figure out which one, or these three could also be correct, because we're dealing with a multivariate problem. It could be a combination of all three in some percentage more than others.
But we do know the fossil fuel industry is dumping more methane into the atmosphere than ever happened before the Industrial Revolution.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's definitely true, but it's still hard to reconcile the isotope budget with fossil fuel alone, I think.
So when we take these new papers into consideration, you find there's some good news hidden in the way strong warming methane is increasing. What's the good news part of this?
Well, so first of all, the first paper about clathrates and old carbon in permafrost are straight up good news. We say that clathrate, even if they destabilize, they're unlikely to significantly affect atmospheric methane, and the old carbon in permafrost also are unlikely to be emitted to the atmosphere as methane. With regards to the findings that fossil fuel emission has been higher all along under our nose, the kind of good news is that that means that we have more control over what we emit. So any regulation that reduce leaks from pipelines or like prevent like flaring or regulate abandoned drill rigs to make sure that oil companies, after they finish with their site, they clean it up and they make sure that everything is capped off and not leaking, they have significantly more leverage against the current methane rise than we thought. So they give you more bang for your buck of regulation costs. And another good news is that basically the methane in the atmosphere is in our hand, and if you flunk it, then it's your fault. Like you don't have anyone else to blame but human emissions. You can't blame the permafrost, you can't blame the clutch rates.
After publishing two papers in major journals and following two pretty big expeditions to Greenland and Antarctica, what is next for you, Michael?
I'm still doing methane stuff. I just submitted my PhD dissertation last week, and I'm going to take up a postdoc in University of Copenhagen, which is one of the pioneering places where they start drilling ice cores. So, yeah, I'm excited to go there in the next couple of months.
Well, you can find links to these two papers in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Follow up and make your own judgment. From the University of Rochester, Michael Dionysius, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
As I tried to make clear in this interview, I would not say the science on what will happen with Arctic methane is totally settled. The actual numbers about methane in past warmer climates is not in dispute, but some other scientists still question whether this applies to the present. Personally, I agree that the real threat is our unregulated emissions from the natural gas industry and the oil industry that vents gas as a byproduct. And we can do a lot to stop it from our own industry. I'm Alex Smith. See you next week on Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.